All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Morality of Everyday Things. Not the Mortality of Everyday Things.
As someone incorrectly tagged us the other day. I'm Anthony.
I'm Jacob.
We're longtime friends, business co-founders, maybe one day lovers. But for now, not. And we're here to discuss everyday moral things with you.
Last episode, you'll remember, to anyone who's tuned in, the question was around whether you should buy your Christmas gifts this holiday season from Amazon.
Yeah. Now, rather than thinking about getting your stuff from Bezos, we're going to be thinking about getting it from the big man with the beard.
That's right. It's Mr. Santa Claus.
Yeah. specifically. I mean, Bezos can grow a beard if he wants to. He can go to space if he wants to.
Bezos can do whatever he wants.
Yeah, specifically, the question is, should you lie to your children about Santa Claus? Should we be creating this narrative fiction that there's a big man with a belly and a white beard in red robes who's busting into your house, eating your cookies, drinking your milk, and then he just drops off gifts rather than stealing your TV?
I mean, at least he's acknowledging reciprocity there, right? At least
yes. Yeah, he's like, you gave me cookies. But definitely one to talk about. Some quick stuff, podcast chatter. We got our Spotify Wrapped. Everyone did. Jake, who was your top listen to artist?
My top listen to artist was Imagine Dragons, surprisingly. But wow, they were on a lot of my exercise playlists. So
okay, that's fair.
That's my excuse.
Cool. Well, on the podcast side, some really cool stats. Last year, we had a 150% increase in listens.
Yeah.
So far, there's been 26,000 total listens, I believe. Much more interestingly, on Spotify, there are 140 people for whom we are their favorite podcast. They listen to us more than any other podcast. That's pretty cool when you think Spotify probably has, what, a bit under 50% market share? Assuming Spotify people aren't particularly behaviorally different, that means there's probably about 250 total for whom we are their favorite podcast.
So that's thank you, guys. Thank you for tuning in. Very, very quickly as well, a note from the sponsor. As we mentioned last time, we've got a sponsor. We're big shots now. And speaking of becoming big shot podcasters, Zencastr is the all-in-one podcasting studio that you can access from your browser. No installation needed. Just get on the site and send a link to your guests and you can get started recording studio quality audio and now video too.
There's automatic post-production. All guests have their own audio channels and all files are stored in the cloud for easy access and peace of mind. In our own experience doing podcast stuff, it is a huge benefit having the audio files and video files kind of separate so that you can edit and splice stuff together. You know, if you're both talking on one audio file, there's no way to separate that.
So check out Zencastr.com. We've got a code in the show notes, The Morality of Everyday Things, no spaces. And we've also got a link for 30% discount on your subscription for the first 3 months. So enough of that. Let's get into today's episode. And as we said, we're continuing with the festive theme. And what's the question today exactly?
Well, that's a good question. The question is, should you lie to your kids about Santa Claus?
So, in defining terms, there's really only one major one. Well, two. I mean, we'll talk about lying, obviously. But the first thing to define here is Santa Claus.
Mm.
Spoilers ahead, Santa Claus is a fictional character.
You what?
What? Generally described as a large, white, bearded man who lives in the North Pole and is responsible for every gift that kids receive for Christmas.
So, grammar check. You said large, white, bearded man. Is he a large, white man with a beard or a man with a large, white beard?
It's white dash bearded. Do you know
so
what?
Large, white bearded.
Yeah.
So it is the beard that's large.
It's the beard that's white.
So wait, is he large or is the beard large?
Well, both, I think.
Yes, strictly both are correct, but the grammar makes it unclear. Carry on.
Yeah, it's true. I don't even know whether the comma would help where you put it. Anyway, you can't see the commas, you guys.
If it's large, comma, white bearded man, that means he's a large man with a white beard. If it's large white bearded man, he's a man with a large white beard.
Is it?
There you go.
Well, what about if he's white?
You'd go large, comma, white bearded, comma, white man.
Anyway, Mr. Santa Claus has been depriving parents of well-deserved thank yous for their presents for over 100 years now.
What a dick. As for the origins of Santa Claus, because I actually personally, and we're going to a little history diatribe, which I think is interesting. It's commonly accepted that he is a highly fictionalized interpretation of Saint Nicholas, as opposed to those lowly fictionalized versions people keep talking about.
And who is Saint Nicholas?
So Saint Nicholas was, by the way, my middle namesake. My middle name is Nicholas, a Greek Christian who was renowned for giving gifts to the poor. I take a lot from my namesake.
On the cookie eating side, absolutely.
On the cookie eating mostly. I do stuff. Although it is debated as to whether this is the sole influence of Saint Nicholas, Santa Claus.
Christianity spent an awful lot of time in Europe taking local pagan myths and stories and rebranding them to be more Christian.
Do you have any examples other than Christmas?
Oh, I do. The Irish pantheon called the, I don't know how you say that, Tyke.
Tuatha De Danann.
Cool. Well, the Irish pantheon, blah,
blah, blah. Tuatha De Danann.
what a wonderful phrase. Hakuna Matata. Anyway, they were rebranded as mortal kings who were blessed by God.
When I was a young warthog.
Another example is Merlin, who everyone's probably familiar with, the wizard. He was rebranded as an attempted antichrist who was baptized and through the will of God retained his powers. So,
wait, Merlin was a real person?
Tige?
No.
Okay. It was just a rebranding of another story, right? As in, what Tyke's saying is Christians used to take local myths and...
So Merlin was a pagan myth?
Yes.
Yes.
Apparently so.
Okay.
Anyway, there's lots of examples of this going on. And the point here is that this is probably something that Christian tradition has done again with the story of St. Nicholas.
Yeah, and there is an argument that Santa, being based on a Christian figure, is another example of this kind of appropriation of pagan or other cultural icons into, you know, their absorption into Christianity. Mm-hmm. There's suggestion that Santa's real origins may actually be in the form of Odin.
So Odin is the Germanic god.
Or Norse.
A white-bearded guy. Wait, is he large white-bearded?
Is he large? Is the beard large?
Anyway, also from the north, who knew whether people had been naughty or nice, would leave gifts for people in their boots and had a habit of entering houses through the chimney, as well as riding beasts of burden through the night sky, one night a year during the middle of winter, which is... You know, there's a lot of overlap.
Yeah, but I mean, like, doesn't everyone do that every now and then? Like, also interesting, so that just reminded me, I mentioned this before the podcast. You said leaving gifts for people in their boots. We should have done a little more research on this.
No, but I think that's where stockings come from, right?
Wait, hear me out. I think it's interesting how, you know, a lot of people become so fixated on their local Christmas traditions, and particularly we kind of all get an Americanized version through media and stuff. But actually, you know, even across Europe, there's lots of different ways that people actually celebrate Christmas. Mm. So if I recall correctly, in Iceland, you know, New Year's Eve, you read and eat chocolate and give each other gifts. So some places you exchange gifts on New Year's Eve. Christmas Eve.
Yep.
Some places you exchange gifts on Christmas Eve. In some Orthodox countries, they actually celebrate everything on the 6th of January, which is the 12 days after. It's Three Kings Day. It's because it's like the kings giving Jesus gifts. And so, sorry, the boots thing reminded me. I was born in Holland, and I was saying before this, instead of putting presents under the tree, you would put your shoe out and you'd put a carrot in your shoe. For the reindeer, and then the carrot would be swapped for a gift.
Good exchange, isn't it?
Yeah, so this leaving gifts for people in their boots, that's actually exactly that. But could also be where stockings come from.
Well, I imagine that is exactly where the tradition of stockings come from. And it's interesting because in the UK, or at least the way we always did it was, you leave a stocking at the end of your bed, you'd wake up, that would be full of presents, and then you do gifts at some point on Christmas Day itself. Yeah. But I can't remember whether we actually spent a Christmas in Germany or just my mum has in the past, and so she always used to say, oh, in Germany, Christmas Eve is when you do gifts. So that was always like an exciting, like, oh, this year we get...
Yeah. Question, actually. Mm. If Santa is supposed to be the one doing gifts to people, why do we have gifts under the tree? For so much longer? Like, is the suggestion that Santa came early and they're waiting there?
Oh, as in, why do we have that as like decoration?
Yeah. Or is the idea that you put gifts under the tree and then Santa adds gifts on
Santa
on
knows
Christmas
where to leave them.
I don't know. It's an interesting thought.
It is. It's a sort of, I guess it's a blurring of the sort of the story and just like the practical realities.
But anyway, carrying on about Santa. Nowadays, Santa Claus is considered synonymous with Father Christmas. You know, this is actually something we were saying before. I didn't realize there was a distinction, but
before
the 1880s, they were considered separate beings. Over time, though, these two different characters that shared several traits, you know, in common began to merge, both large white-bearded men. This process is called syncretism. Wow. And with these characters, the fusing is likely to have occurred at between 1864 and 1880. Fusion, ha! That's a Dragon Ball Z reference. In 1864, an author named Susanna Warner wrote a story depicting the two as separate characters that year. And by the 1880s, they were widely considered to be one character, with Father Christmas commonly accepted to come down the chimney to leave gifts in stockings.
Again, it's posited that Santa and Father Christmas share a common origin. One name for Odin, remember him, was Yolfather, meaning Yule Father, and Yule was what Christmas used to be called. So this would imply that Father Christmas was also based on Odin, meaning that their merging in the 1880s was actually possibly a re-merging of two characters who were originally the same character anyway. So it's like the myth has split and then come back together.
Also, just on that, so you're talking about Christian adoption of pagan rituals, and you said Yule was what Christmas used to be called. Mm. I think Yuletide was actually like the pagan stuff, the term for pagan ritual pre-Christianity. I could be totally wrong.
What would that be?
the term Yule retained quite a while after Christianity took it over. They only rebranded the name relatively recently.
Interesting.
There you go.
So it was Yule before Christianity as well?
And after.
And what did Yule refer to? Just like a sort of winter?
The cake, festival. Yule log.
Just the general time, gift-giving traditions.
Yuletide. So, that's a lot about Santa.
Mm-hmm.
Now the important part to today's question and our podcast. In the UK, at least, and certainly through American media,
mm-hmm.
it's not uncommon for people, I say not uncommon, it is the expectation in some sense, for people to lie to their children about the existence of Santa, telling them about his flying reindeer, his diminutive workers.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, I like that. Politically correct.
and his, the elves.
Yeah. And his love for cookies, like it's a fact and not a fiction.
And like you're saying, I mean, you said it's a sort of expectation. Not only that, it's kind of a taboo to mention that Santa is fictional in front of small children.
Yeah, it's, well, I mean, first of all, technically, does that make it a conspiracy? And then secondly,
Who benefits? Follow the money, Anthony.
Jet fuel doesn't melt steel beams, Jacob. So it does make me think, right? Like, say you went to like a shopping center and started shouting out like Santa's not real or whatever. On the one hand, you know, you certainly wouldn't be doing anything illegal.
Mm.
But on the other, a lot of people would be very annoyed with you, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think people would definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they would be. And it's a weird one, isn't it? Because conspiracy probably isn't quite the right word. We had good definitions of conspiracy once, possibly.
Previous. Conspiracy theory. The term conspiracy theory has a specific definition. Conspiracy is just a word.
Yeah, there are certain like connotations of that. Anyway.
Yeah. So I think the main thing about conspiracy theory is that it has to have circular logic.
Yeah, it's sort of evidence that looks to disprove it can be interpreted as proof of its existence. Like, well, that's what they want you to think.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, because then it's the point is that they're impossible to logically argue with.
Exactly. But if Santa is a conspiracy theory, it is one that most people tend to uncover the truth about at some point, because there aren't many adults who cling to the existence of Santa, or hopefully, guys.
There aren't many
listening. I'm sorry.
There aren't many well-adjusted adults who cling to the existence of Santa. Let's quickly. Jake, when did you? I can't remember, but when did? Oh, I do remember. When did you realize Santa's not real?
Well, this is the problem. I don't.
Never did.
Not that I never did. I'm just, a lot of people, we will talk about this because there's a term for this, which is the JFK effect. A lot of people seem to have very distinct memories of the moment they realized Santa wasn't real. And I absolutely don't.
The JFK effect.
Yeah.
Because that is so 1960s, 70s. When was it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like a much more appropriate one would be the 9/11 effect.
Well, for our generation.
Yeah, for our generation, millennials. Yeah. And I think most of our listeners are probably millennials. In fact, I know that because I look at the podcast stats. But yes.
But no, I don't. What about yourself? Do you remember?
So I had some neighbors. Well, first of all, I feel a little bit like, sorry if we have religious listeners, I feel like a little bit like religion. I never really literally believed it because obviously it didn't make sense. Like I remember I was staying at a friend and he went to Sunday school, you know, just like religious stuff. I was like, yeah, whatever, I'll go with him because I'm staying with him. I must have been like 5 or 6 or something. I remember like people were talking and it just kind of clicked at some point. I was like, oh, whoa, these people are being literal. They literally believe this. Like they literally believe that. And I was like, whoa. So I never, you know, I never kind of really literally believed the Santa stuff or the religious stuff. God, I'm smart. yeah, that makes me a douche. But no, I like in my head, in my heart, I never was like, yes, this is literally, I literally believe there's a man flying around. But you know, you kind of hear it and you hear stories and you know, you're not like, okay, this is all a lie, my parents do it yet. The time that it really added up for me and I had to bring it to my parents and interrogate them, I had some neighbors who were American. And in typical American fashion, they were quite overweight. I just remember, you know, I was a kid, I liked chocolate. And I just remember Christmas comes, you know, we get gifts. And these kids got tons of chocolate. And I was like, I like chocolate. Why didn't I get tons of chocolate? And then it hit me. It's because their parents bought it for them. And the little parents saw their little piggy kids and were like, these kids need chocolate.
Tig, you had a good story about this, didn't you? About when you discovered that Santa wasn't real.
Yes, I did. I was going home from a New Year's Eve party at a friend's house. A wealthier friend.
Wait, how old were you?
I was, I think, about 7 years old.
17.
Right. Yeah, when you said going home from a New Year's Eve party, I was like, what?
Oh, yeah, because I was with my parents because I was so young, a small child, and
mm-hmm.
and it came to me.
Sorry, diminutive.
It occurred to me, it was kind of strange that the richer friend was getting the better gifts because he had just gotten the brand spanking new Nintendo Wii, which at the time was pretty expensive. And I got some DS games. I was like, well, if Santa was an egalitarian, you know, he would spread things out.
Who said
out.
That? Who said that's the case, though?
He's supposed to be fair. He would spread things out a little bit, but then he didn't. And I was on my walk home with my light up trainers, and it came to me in an instant. Oh, Santa's not real. It's the parents.
Yeah.
Wow.
Like a light bulb, but on your feet instead of over your head.
Okay, so that's lots of good context about Santa.
And our personal histories.
And our histories. The question, though, was, is it, well, should parents lie about Santa? And I suppose we have to start then by asking, why do parents lie about Santa?
I think a little bit about
why
the reasons.
Why did it start? And the primary reason seems to be that the Santa story is fun. Telling it, getting kids to engage with it is just cute
part of the,
for
part
parents.
Of the fantasy sort of Christmas time,
the magic
right?
Of
part
Christmas.
Of the excitement.
And possibly, as a distant second reason, some scientists and philosophers and people have argued that it aids cognitive development in children. Wow. I don't know that that's necessarily what parents are going
for.
In my
experience, lying to children definitely helps them develop. secure, trusting adults.
I think anyone who's sort of seen this title of this podcast and been like, what? Why would you even ask the question? Is basically just someone who, you just feel bought into the story. You're like, it's magical, it's fun, it's cute.
Yep.
Like,
yeah. And maybe we're cynics, or maybe we're Grinches for talking about it. We'll come to that in a second.
Mr. Grinch.
But then specifically, and we will attack this point, you use the term aids cognitive development. I think a lot of people specifically think it helps develop moral understanding, right?
Why?
Well, it's a very simple moral tool to say, if you're not nice, you won't get gifts, right?
And that's true. It's almost a sort of discipline thing around Christmas, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of, I'm outing myself as a neo-Marxist, but as Marx says, religion is the opiate of the masses, so Santa is the opiate of children. You don't need to understand why, just do the right thing, okay?
Interesting.
Anyway, arguably, the Santa story became the Santa lie. Specifically, do you know when?
In 1897.
Ah, you read the notes.
I do. I read the article, actually, because it's interesting.
Oh, did you? Okay. Yeah. An 8-year-old girl called Virginia O'Hanlon sent a letter to the New York Sun asking if Santa was real. Since some of her friends had told her he wasn't, she said that her father had told her that if you see it in the sun, it is so. So, in response to this letter, the Sun printed an editorial saying that Santa was certainly real and that her little friends are wrong. Translation. Your friends are dicks. Scathing.
So I did check out the original thing because it's, to this day, it stands as one of the most widely reprinted newspaper editorials in the English language. And it's, yeah, I mean, it's certainly a precedent for parents to convince their children that Santa exists. It's interesting, though, because it's super patronizing.
Yeah. Oh, is it?
The whole thing is just like, your little friends are wrong. They have little minds.
Very conspiracy theory vibes.
It's done in a sort of cute way, but it definitely comes across as like, don't believe them, little girl.
But it is the 1890s.
It is.
Not to be confused with the 1990s.
I don't think anyone
makes that confusion. But I think also, you said it sets precedent for parents to convince their children that Santa exists. A little bit more than that, I think it sets that precedent where it's communally agreed that everyone has to do it, right? In the same way that, like, you know, if a stranger, I was talking about strangers in shopping malls earlier, you know, that's how I spend my weekends. if a stranger comes up to you, you heard a parent and a child arguing in a shopping center, and they were saying, the kid's saying Santa's not real, and the parent's saying, of course he is. And the parent turned to you and said, isn't Santa real? The expectation would be that you say yes, right? Mm-hmm. And similarly, the expectation is that the news either doesn't mention it or says he's real, right? In a playful way for children. Mm-hmm. So it kind of sets that precedent more than that just parents should do it. That like everyone, as an adult, it is your responsibility to be in on this conspiracy, which actually is kind of a fun thing about it. It's part of being an adult when you, I remember that transition from child to teenager where you swap sides.
Yeah.
And it becomes your job to help convince the children.
Yeah. What you're saying is it's basically part of our culture, right? It just becomes a sort of cultural norm.
So now Santa is not just a precedent familiarly, but within our culture.
Exactly. As we said, I mean, the biggest argument in favor of this, just like you were saying, is that it's fun to play along with the idea of a man who uses magic for strictly kind purposes. He's like this benevolent figure. He rides a magic sleigh pulled by exotic reindeer.
Not really
not
exotic,
that exotic
in the north.
But they are.
Fly.
They pulled by flying reindeer. That's, I guess, fairly exotic.
It's a flying animal exotic or magical?
Well, definitely.
Why
definitely
not both?
Magical. Why not both? It's like a unicorn. But yeah, it's a fun story, and that's the way that most people feel about it.
I mean, that's a subjective opinion, but it's a common opinion. Another arguable benefit comes from a study conducted by the University of Oregon in 1997, mm-hmm. not to be confused with 1897.
Again.
It finds that children who live lives rich with fantasy in the form of make-believe, fantasy play, imaginary friends, etc., are better at distinguishing appearance from reality, understanding the expectations of others, and comprehending that people can come to different conclusions about something based on what they know. Essentially, their development of theory of mind is hastened. Melinda Wenner-Moyer, author of How to Raise Kids Who Aren't Assholes, argues that that's a great name. Argues that Santa counts as a fantasy that aids the mental development of children, and so it's not only a harmless lie, but a beneficial one. Quick interjection there, though, because mm-hmm. we were discussing this before. I don't want to get into the semantics, but specifically when we're talking about fantasy, part of fantasy generally is knowing that it's not true, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So does Santa count as a fantasy? I mean, like, you know, we don't say that children who are, the example we said earlier was, we don't say children who are raised in cults are engaging in fantasy and it's positive for their development, right? They're being lied to. They're part of a conspiracy theory.
And I suppose, I mean, maybe yes, just because it sort of rests on the fact that adults know it's not true. Whereas that's the difference with the cult,
and
right?
And it's accepted that the children will learn that it's not true.
Yeah.
And like I said earlier, maybe there's a little bit where, like, except for very, very small children who believe anything you tell them, mm-hmm. they're, you know, most kids, there should be a little bit where it's like, they probably don't literally believe it.
They're like, logistically, how does he get around to all these houses?
Exactly.
Do you remember when Google Maps did that? What? They made a little Santa model and they were like, this is where Santa is over the earth right now.
Isn't there a thing, NORAD or something like that? Where they do that? They do, like, anyway.
I'm sure there is. But yeah, no, it's an interesting question and a fair one. It's like, yeah, where does it sit in the realm of, like, you must believe this versus it's sort of fancy. And I guess the process that kids go through is that. Is that transition, yeah. isn't it?
When you sit down and play Dungeons and Dragons, that's fantasy, right? But no one there literally believes that they're a troll-hunting dwarf paladin, right? Mm.
It's interesting, though, because another example of that is, you remember when Harry Potter came out and was, like, super popular? And you actually did have so many kids who were like, I want my letter from Hogwarts. Like, you know?
Yeah. But they must have, at some level, you know, realized that that's not. Every time they saw an owl, it was like, oh my god,
the evidence is everywhere. But yeah, it's an interesting point, and it's one that not all philosophers do agree on when we're talking about the aiding the mental development thing. So there's a guy called Tom Flynn, and we'll probably reference him again in a bit, because he wrote This Is the Trouble with Christmas, and he argues in his book that representations in the media teach our children to despise anyone whose feelings towards the holiday deviate from the mainstream, and this includes the lack of belief in Santa Claus. So people like Scrooge in A Christmas Carol, the Grinch in How the Grinch Stole Christmas, and parents potentially who don't partake in the Santa story. He's basically saying, you know, this is, it's bad. And then I remember, people who don't play along are just like, yeah.
I remember I saw where I get most of my information from. I saw some memes about the Grinch. And the Grinch was just like, it was like, so what you're telling me is this guy got ostracized from the community because he was different, and then he wanted to be alone, and everyone was mean to him. Wow. Anyway.
So there's a lot of stuff on Santa, right?
Talk a lot about Santa, talk a lot about why people lie about Santa. Let's talk about lying more specifically. Not a new theme. We've discussed this before, but a big theme. So let's have a look now at what philosophers have to say about the morality of lying. A little review. And is the Santa lie morally permissible in that context? So generally, most philosophers seem to either think that lying is always morally wrong, or if not, that it is only able to be overridden by other moral reasons, you know, some sort of greater good.
So we've obviously heard plenty in the past about our man, Mr. Kant, who argues that honesty is a perfect duty. Lying is therefore always wrong. Because if lying was universalized, we'd have a world where everyone lied, so nobody would trust anything anyone ever said. And in that framework, lying just doesn't make sense.
But
you
wait,
shouldn't lie.
We do live in a world where people lie, so why should I trust what you just said?
What? believe nothing.
So if we take it to be that a person should not be treated as a means to an end, it might be argued that telling children the Santa lie treats them merely as a means to an end they cannot share in, because they do not know what that end is, provided Kant considers children as counting as rational persons, which isn't necessarily a given. We'll come back to that.
Kant's view then is fairly clear-cut. Don't lie. Clint always struck me as a bit of a grinchy kind of bloke.
I could see that. I could see him being a grinch. So from a consequentialist perspective, actions are judged to be good or bad based on their outcomes. And so lying to a child is allowed if it's for some greater good. But that brings us to the question of whether the Santa lie does more good than harm. As we'll get to later, there are arguments for and arguments against that.
Yeah, so sticking with that, if we go back to the Greek tradition, as argued by Plato, lying can be justified in some circumstances. And this is followed by, as you say, other consequentialist perspectives like Mill and even John Milton.
Yeah. Mill, famous utilitarian. So the Greek tradition, as verbalized by Plato, I haven't read it myself, but invariably it would be through the mouth of Socrates. have you seen that meme where it's like, oh, we've actually posted it on our Instagram account where it's like, ah, Socratic dialogue is like the richest form of philosophy. And it's like, huge block of text. Yes, Socrates. Huge block of text. Of course, Socrates. for anyone who hasn't read any Plato, actually surprisingly readable and enjoyable, it's, yeah, basically Socrates just talks at people.
Yeah.
Which, like, every impression I get of the man is that he's an incredibly annoying person, and that's very accurate. I feel like I relate to this person a little too much. But yes, the Greek tradition says that the permissibility of lying depends on the relationship had between the persons, in part. And one of these relationships that seems to make a difference is between a parent and a child. But the case given for this is that adults, quote, adults were permitted to lie to children who were sick, however, in order to get them to take medicine. So that's an example of when that would be permissible.
So this suggests it is for a greater good that the child is unable to understand. But is the Santa lie justifiable on these grounds?
Obviously, it's not as clear-cut as lying to a child to get them to take their medicine, mm-hmm. right? I feel like that's obviously the mm-hmm. case. We'll discuss the back and forth, but my initial interpretation is no. And so let's talk more about this relationship between two people as well. Effectively, it's saying that, I guess, adults have a responsibility over a child. Does this mean that you as a parent have a different responsibility to you as a stranger? So as a parent, I gave an example earlier where a parent and child are arguing, the parent would ask you in a way that's suggestive that they want you to agree. And then actually you're kind of appealing to what the parent would like to tell the child because it's the parent's decision and responsibility to take care of the child and teach them. What if it was the other way around? What if a parent and child were arguing, child was saying something, and the parent was saying, look, no, you're old enough that you need to know the truth. Santa's not real. And then the parent asked you in that context. I actually feel like the important thing there is the relationship between the parent and the child, not the cultural norm of Santa being real, right? Like if a parent asked you in that context, I feel like I would probably be like, yeah, look, kid, like... get ready for this one. I'm about to blow your Christmas bubble.
Who are you in this context? You're saying if a parent.
So I'm saying if a parent and child were arguing next to you,
okay,
and the parent is trying to explain to the child that Santa's not real, mm-hmm. and then turn to you to ratify that, I would probably ratify it. And so it seems that when I consider, this is what I'm saying. When I actually consider that analogy I gave earlier, perhaps it's not the norm of Santa being real or a cultural norm of like upholding that to be true that's important. Perhaps it's a parent's right to raise their child or educate their child as they see fit. So like I actually, maybe the thing earlier that I'm doing is just agreeing with what a parent says. As long as it's harmless, I'd probably go along with the parent no matter what they said when they're talking to a child.
Yeah, that's a big caveat though, right? So long as it's harmless.
Yes, yeah. But I mean like...
Which is why, I mean, you can use that to justify why you would agree Santa is real or...
Yeah, I mean, taking overall, I mean, well, obviously we're discussing it as the point of this question, but like, I don't think it's super harmful or super good either way, right? Like it's relatively benign.
I think the practical thing there is probably just non-interference.
Yes.
Just be like, oh, is that a bird?
That's so Kantian of you.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, like, look, in this case, you're not even telling a lie, right? So what's your answer to this analogy I've given or thought experiment I've given? Like if a parent was telling a child that Santa's not real and then asked you, please, can you explain to my child that Santa's not real? Can you confirm that that's true? What would you do?
It's a tough one. I really don't know. I feel like it's...
Interesting. I would immediately be like, yeah, fine. And the overriding thing for me is the parents' rights to educate and raise their child.
I guess it probably depends a little bit on the child, right? Like if the child is...
the child is 16.
Exactly. Then it's like, okay, listen. I don't know. I mean, I see your point about sort of parental responsibility.
Yeah.
It depends. If it's like a really young child and they're really like upset, are you going to just sort of weigh in and be like, cool, kick them while they're down? That's what I'm saying. For like context.
But I mean, like, you could also, there's a spectrum of possibilities, right? You can kneel down and grab the child on their shoulder and throttle them and say, wake up. No, I mean, you could grab them and be like, hey, look, Santa's not real, but that doesn't mean that Christmas isn't a great time where everyone loves each other and, kumbaya, that kind of.
I don't know if it's your responsibility, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think my tactic probably would be
to avoid.
I think so.
That's fair enough. I think
unless it's like a family member, then it's different.
Yeah, it was just, it's interesting that discussion of the Greek tradition and the relationship between particularly a parent and a child kind of made me reflect on that thought experiment I gave earlier and realize that maybe it's not the cultural norm of Santa that would make me agree with the parent. Maybe it's my respect for their relationship with their child.
Mm. But the cultural norm is, I think, what would make you, like, would make a lot of people uncomfortable.
The cultural norm is the reason why you would be like, disengage.
Yeah, exactly.
Eject. Anyway, that's interesting.
It connects to something really interesting there, though, because it's one thing to sort of like lie, but I in some ways avoiding isn't necessarily this, but there's a bit of a difference between lying and deception, right?
Yes, my ex-girlfriend wouldn't say so. So it's just a joke. I didn't lie or deceive. If you're listening, it's just a joke.
So now we'll believe you.
Yeah, nothing makes it. Anyway, lying and deception can come apart. You can deceive someone without lying to them. For example, lies by omission. So, I mean, you know, in the context of the analogy we just gave, you would be deceiving that child by refusing to answer the question.
To be fair, I'm not sure I'd be doing anything. I think I'd be neutral in the scenario. But I think it's one of those things where if the child asked you, then you know.
Yeah, well, in the case of the Santa lie, you probably do have to deceive by lying. But sorry, you use the word neutral. It makes me think we were joking on the WhatsApp chat today. Have you ever seen that like Dungeons and Dragons kind of like your morality thing? So you're either good, neutral, or evil, and you're either like chaotic. What are the other two?
Neutral and lawful.
Yes, chaotic, neutral, and lawful. So chaotic is like, I don't follow rules. Lawful is like, rules are paramount. Neutral is like, depends. And good and evil is obvious. Where would you put yourself in this 9-box matrix?
I don't know. I think that's probably too much of a tangent here.
I'd go chaotic, neutral. Anyway, yes, talking about lying and deception come apart. In this case, Santa is more of a lie than deception. There are times when you may use deception, but generally it's an active lie. I mean, at some point, they need to literally be told I guess now there's so much cultural stuff they could pick it up from somewhere else, but yeah, most children at some point are literally told Santa is real and he flies around, blah blah blah.
Yeah, I guess the sort of assumption here is deception is a slightly more passive state of affairs, and there are people who take a stance on this and you call them moral deceptionists.
Not to be confused with moral receptionists, as Google Sheets tries to autocorrect it to.
So moral deceptionists believe that any untruthful statement made with the intent to deceive is a violation of the person being lied to. So this is based on the idea if you hear someone say something, you have a right to assume that they believe it, and that by lying, that right is being violated.
Interesting. Okay, so this view does not include lying by omission or deceptive vagueness. Whew.
Confusing.
No, I mean, just, you know, deceptive vagueness. I can still do it without upsetting moral deceptionists. So by their view, it's very much possible and not a violation to convince a kid of Santa's existence without ever saying anything explicitly untrue. Dad, is Santa real? Don't you see the presents under the tree, child of mine? How else do you suppose they got there, child of mine?
Yeah, it's a classic. You've not actually, like, you've not answered the question. You've not sort of said anything direct, but you've kept up the story, haven't you, by answering questions with another question. Excellent tactic there. Anyway, interestingly, so I don't know if we've mentioned this guy already. The name Grotius.
Who's Grotius?
Who is Grotius, Tig?
I assumed you knew.
Hugo Grotius.
Anyway, sorry.
Hugo de Groot was a Dutch humanist, diplomat, lawyer, theologian, jurist, poet, and playwright. So, philosopher of sorts.
Yeah, we've got this philosopher called Grotius who argues that you can only lie to those who have freedom of judgment. And so children, not being rational beings, his words not mine, are fair game. This perspective seems to openly endorse lying about Santa, since it's a lie that is only really told to children.
Yes. And yeah, to be fair, I think generally, again, going back to the parental thing, you know, most people think that benign lies, even just to get your child to shut up, are generally considered fine. Like, no one thinks you're a bad person for that. And also this whole, like, children aren't rational beings yet. I mean, one, objectively probably fair when you think about yourself as like a 6-year-old. And two, it's also enshrined in other parts of our culture and law. So, for example, we set a cutoff of 18 for voting, right? I mean, on the one hand, I don't think anyone's arguing that 6-year-olds should be able to vote, but it's kind of hard to justify why not when you give a bunch of human arguments, unless you create some caveat that explains that children are morally or rationally distinct from adults. I mean, as to whether the line should be at 18 specifically is a different, is a more specific argument, but the overall thing, why shouldn't everyone just be able to vote? Like, there are plenty of adults who, you know, have repugnant, stupid views and we allow them to vote. So why does your level of rationality matter? But you know,
well,
we just...
maybe not your rationality, but your age, right? That's
yes.
the point.
Yeah, it? Yeah. Why does your age matter?
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting because that's a good political example. But it, even in philosophy, children's rights are generally treated differently to
yes.
adult rights.
Yes, yeah,
because
yeah.
it's claimed that it's not obvious that they're owed the same kinds of rights as owed to adults, given their status is not secured in the same way. And when we talk about the status as rational persons, it kind of basically follows Locke and his assertion that children aren't capable of being responsible for their actions. And because of this, like, it seems to rest on that sort of premise of like, how responsible are you? How good are you at assessing the consequences if you take that approach?
Or... Again, enshrined in actual law.
Yeah.
Treatment of under 18s is very different to treatment
of
over 18s.
Yeah, punishment, exactly. Yep. It's not necessarily done to deny children of welfare rights. I mean, your children are still entitled to a lot of the same welfare that we grant adults, water, all these sorts of things.
Water.
Is that why water?
So gracious of you.
Got a bottle of water here. Just first thing I looked at.
Yeah.
I love lamp.
I love lamp.
But yeah, it's not to say children should be deserving of lesser welfare. It's just that if they can't be deemed responsible for their actions, they're not necessarily the same level of rationality.
Yes.
And therefore, do we treat them differently in a moral framework.
It's funny how, like, you know, something you're trying to do to their benefit, i.e., oh, you know, children can't be considered responsible, children are a special case, etc., is also the thing that basically says they're morally distinct and maybe lesser in the same way that, you know, and
it's like
not
animals,
in the same
right?
way, but not, animal. I was about to say, like, animals,
Not literally to the same level, but like.
Yeah. I always say babies are a bit like pet dogs. But it does pose an interesting question as to whether or not it is actually wrong to lie or deceive to children if, you know, if they do not have the status of rational persons, and to lie is not really to the detriment of their welfare. However, I don't think this is a terribly positive argument for the Santa lie.
Yeah. So I guess that's the interesting thing, isn't it? It's like lying is still sort of generally considered to be morally bad. So whether or not you carve out children as a different category of moral agent, it doesn't necessarily like matter to the sort of, you know, beneficence of lying.
Cool. So, reasons against telling.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Santa lie, Jacob.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess number one, we've looked at lying in general and why that might be wrong. And if you want to take a hardline approach, you could say, you know, lying is bad and therefore I wouldn't lie to my kids about Santa. You shouldn't do it. But there are obviously, you know, that's a bit of a strict view, and there's lots more to think about with this issue. So coming back to the question, asking if it's wrong, let's look at some more arguments that we can consider.
Yeah. Sorry, I know that we don't put much time into discussing why it might be right. We've just taken it that it is that overall argument.
It's
like
fun.
It's fun.
Yeah, fun and
you know,
magic.
Kids enjoy it. Blah,
that
blah,
was
blah.
The kind of yeah. why. Yeah. When
some
we
people.
About why
yeah. Of course.
Do it.
Okay. Some people think it's cognitively beneficial. Maybe there's some moral learning there. Okay. So some of the core arguments against telling the Santa lie are that it's, first of all, a dubious discipline tool. So this is, you know, some people might say it helps instill moral understanding by giving it in a clear and understandable way to the children. Actually, it could be a bad way of teaching them. It can break down trust between a child and their parents. And it's a revelation as a lie can permanently tarnish a child's view of Christmas.
Now, that all sounds a bit negative. But on the other hand, if you like Santa as a concept and are feeling maybe a bit weighed down by all the philosophical arguments against him in terms of lying and in terms of all the things Ange just said we'll get into, an alternative conception of the debate to keep in mind is not that parents should deprive children entirely of Santa as an idea, but that it should be told as it is, as a story, rather than sort of enforcing that kids genuinely should believe that Santa is real.
So this is coming back to what we were saying about the distinction between fantasy and conspiracy.
Exactly.
Yeah. There's a book called It's a Wonderful Lie.
That's a great title.
That's a great title.
What a pun.
Yeah. For anyone who's Tig, you're quite young yourself. It's a Wonderful Life is a very famous Christmas film.
Tig just rolled his eyes really loudly.
So the book It's a Wonderful Lie is by Christopher Boyle and Kathy McKay, and it lays out a lot of interesting arguments. Santa is often used as a disciplinary tool. When it's approaching Christmas, lots of parents tell their kids that if they misbehave, Santa won't bring them anything or will fill their stocking with coal.
And this is the thing, we said this before, but using a lie to discipline a child seems a bit less than morally upstanding, right?
Yeah. A quote from Tom Flynn, who we mentioned earlier, is the world so bad that we decide that it is better to spend around 10 years lying to children about a large, jolly man, large white bearded man, who gives presents to all children with the help of mythical creatures because it makes for more enjoyment at Christmas. This is the response to the argument that it's nice to lie to children, let them believe the lie. Is it better to let children have 7 to 10 years of believing the magic and then the disappointment that the magic doesn't exist versus just never believing in a magical world in the first place?
That sounds a little bit like, is it better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all?
Oh, man.
Yeah, interesting. Another point of view. Children need to believe their parents in terms of basic survival, i.e. look before you cross the road, be careful when you climb that tree, don't touch that hot iron, etc., etc. I was really hoping one of those was going to be a funny example. Don't put your head in that alligator's mouth.
So unless it's at one of those like aquatic parks where they like, are right, really well trained.
Like a photo
object. Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, yeah, kids are generally predisposed to believe their parents and therefore predisposed to believe things like Santa, even when the evidence suggests that this isn't true.
Yeah, so this is basically this is an argument that it damages trust, right? Yep. It's important that the kids be able to trust their parents, but when a child finds out that they've been lied to for years in such a conspiratorial way.
Conspiratorial.
I was thinking conspiratorial sounds a bit too like hospitable.
Yeah.
Sometimes including very convincing theatrics, like having someone dressed as Santa actually turn up. Mm-hmm. It can damage the trust that they have in their parents. Like, what else have I been lied to about? Although this could be spun as a positive, usually by the time a kid finds out the truth about Santa, they're not small children anymore, and arguably not blindly trusting authority figures is a desirable trait. Maybe it's a reminder. I can see like a super cynical parent being like, this is a reminder to trust no one.
It's like that video of the guy who's like, his kid's on a ladder and he's like, this is the trust test. The kid falls backwards and he just turns the camera and says,
trust no one.
Very harsh.
We mentioned this earlier.
Yes. We said we come back to this, the JFK effect. So this is another thing to consider. So the JFK effect, as a reminder, is the question of, the phenomenon that a lot of people seem to remember where they were when JFK died. I suppose it was a big shocking moment in history. I think for our age group, we said earlier, 9/11.
9/11 is probably one where people like remember where they were.
And it's a question that a surprising number of people can answer with great detail because the event was important, memorable. And revelations such as Santa Claus can have the same effect. Like many people do remember exactly where they were and what they were doing when they found out Santa wasn't real. Not in my case. Yeah. We told our own stories already.
Yeah. I mean, is this an argument that it's a bad thing? Or just how damaging it is that like people remember when they find out?
I think the argument here is that it is, yeah, I think that it's a damaging thing.
Yeah.
Or like it's a...
Yeah. So I suppose the point is that it taints the holiday season for people, making Christmas kind of never feel the same, reminding them of the disappointment of that reveal.
Welcome to life, kids.
Yeah.
I guess the main thing that philosophers also argue, or when I say philosophers, these people have been sort of thinking and writing about this. No, they're not philosophers. Sorry. But generally, the argument is that there's no need for this because Santa is a fun story and fantasy may aid development, but it doesn't mean that the child needs to necessarily believe that it's the truth. You know, most of the stories we tell and enjoy by the campfire, between book covers, in movies, whatever, they're stories that we know are completely made up. I mean, you said before, when you play Dungeons and Dragons, you don't need to believe all this stuff is real in order to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't make it less fun necessarily, does it?
So. Yeah. And the kids in that 97 study who we referenced, University of Oregon one about fantasy play, etc., who showed advanced development from fantasy play, didn't literally believe the fantasies they were engaging in to be real. If they did, that would be an inhibitor of development, since the ability to tell the truth from pretend is a pretty important ability to develop. Right? Or a skill that you need to develop in order to grow as a person. Kyle Johnson argues that teaching kids lies like Santa encourages credulity. Kids can have just as much fun with Santa stories and stuff without being lied to about its existence.
One more point to consider, and I thought this was really interesting, as we only came up with this yesterday.
Yeah, but it reminds me that so much of what we've been talking about so far has been a super middle class perspective.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think a really important thing. Go on.
Let's say that kids do believe the Santa myth. And actually, Tyke, I mean, this kind of speaks to your story that you gave us earlier, right? What moral lessons does this teach the spoiled rich kids who receive gifts no matter what they do, or the deserving kids from families facing tough times who may be wrongly led to believe that the reason they don't receive many gifts is some failing on their part? I mean,
pointing to Tyke's example, it's relevant, but you know, it's relative to the person you're saying who got the Wii and you got the DS. But I mean, like, you know, particularly think about, you know, kids in proper modern day developed world or undeveloped, I guess in a lot of the undeveloped or developing world, there's not really a strong Christmas tradition. But, you know, think about the pressure it puts on parents who are struggling to put food on the table. Think about what it's saying to the children who are in those sort of families where they, you know, I mean, if you believe the Santa myth, the only thing they can take away is that they're bad people. Mm. And that's why Santa's not giving them anything.
Harmful.
Yeah. And you know, even if they're getting gifts, that kind of parallel of like, you know, you're seeing in the movies where everyone's getting like a new bike or whatever and you don't get that, like that's hard on a child who can't understand the context that like Santa's not real and we're constrained by, you know, what we have access to.
Yeah. There's a really sad story. I remember one of the teachers at my school, he went out on Christmas Eve with his family. They came back and their house had been robbed and all the presents were under the tree, just all got taken.
Mate, do you not remember that 2 years ago, all of our gifts that we bought for everyone, God. We bought gifts for everyone in the office and they got stolen.
Yeah.
They were all books and we'd written personal notes in them.
That was very sad. That was very sad. Luckily, none of our team believed that, you know, that was because they performed badly that
But yeah, that would suck for the teacher,
tough,
right?
Tough because he had really young kids. So he was like, shit, like, what do I, you know? What do I tell them? Like,
oh yeah, because then you can't even say like Santa turned up, but someone stole the gifts while we were out.
Yeah.
I mean, if I wanted to engage in the Santa lie, I'd write a note from Santa and I'd say like, I'm very sorry, I left you gifts, but I checked in a couple hours later and I noted that someone had stolen. And you know, the parents, there'd be probably enough evidence that someone actually did break in.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true.
On the other hand, funny thought, and this is coming back to what we're saying, if someone is desperate enough to break into your house on Christmas Eve and steal your Christmas gifts, they probably really fucking need them.
One perspective.
I'm not saying they did the right thing, but I'm, you know, there's kind of a part of me, it's like when someone nicked my backpack that had all the gifts that we had for everyone else. It's like, on the one hand, you know, those guys suck and I'm really angry at them. On the other hand, if your life is bad enough that you need to be going around nicking backpacks full of gifts, like, really, I'm not really jealous of your circumstance, and like, yeah, I'm kind of sorry that life has kind of brought you to that point.
That's a upstanding and sort of pitying perspective, isn't it?
It's like it's a very patronizing perspective, I'll take that.
But okay, I think we've now talked about everything, and it's time to draw our own conclusions. So where do you stand on this?
I feel like I didn't come into this with a strong perspective and I leave it with a weak perspective. I just don't know until I'm in that position with children.
So I feel, yeah, let's say you have like young cousins or one day kids of your own.
My number one thing that I made clear earlier is I will always respect other parents' decisions as to how to raise their children, mm-hmm. right? So if anyone, unless the child is like ridiculously old, like 10, you know, if anyone is engaging in the Santa lie with their children, I will respect that decision, mm-hmm. always. Because my primary overriding respect is to the relationship between parent and child as opposed to the Santa cultural norm.
Sure.
In my own case, I feel like I'm leaning towards the Santa story thing. You know, I feel like I'm leaning towards the Santa deception versus the Santa lie. I wouldn't actively tell my children, you must believe this. Mm. But I feel like I would engage in like telling them the story and not necessarily pointing out that it's not true.
Yeah.
Yeah? What do you think?
Well, I think it's really tricky because I think the sort of Santa story as opposed to the Santa lie, where you're like, you know what? You tell all the Santa stories and you are just like, oh, they're stories at the end of the day. That certainly ticks all the boxes in terms of like, if you want to go away feeling like you're moral and you've thought about everything. That seems like the right answer. However, I do feel like faced with a little kid whose eyes are sort of like wide with the magic of like, wow, is Santa coming? It's really, really hard to be like, it's a cute story, isn't it?
Listen, you're a loser. Life's tough. Get used to it.
I think maybe it is that sort of deception point of like, I guess culturally there's enough stuff about Santa anyway.
It feels like the over-intellectualizing and rationalizing of something that's just a bit fun.
Right? I think so. Well, wait,
could you say
fair,
the whole episode is?
To be fair, when we first asked this question, I think that was my vague sense of the beginning. It was like, oh, how much does this actually matter in practice? Yeah. But it's been really interesting to discuss.
Yeah. I tell you, one thing I definitely wouldn't do, mm-hmm. is that I wouldn't use it as a moral teaching.
You wouldn't use Santa as a disciplinary thing?
No.
That's an interesting take.
Okay, maybe one day when I'm exhausted and I have children, I'll be like, oh, whatever, yeah.
And what, you're getting cold this year.
but I really, like, I mean, more deeply than that, and it's the same issue that I have with religion as a moral teaching method. Mm. I really think that the understanding of morality should be much more intrinsic than extrinsic. And what you really want to instill in people is this feeling that, like, doing the right thing will make you feel good and actually raise them in a way that kind of becomes true.
I know, as opposed to a functioning part of society.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
all about corporations.
This is the religious argument. It's like, oh, if there was no punishments or whatever, people would be out raping each other.
Yeah, it's like the heaven and hell thing, right?
Yeah, it's like without heaven and hell, killing each other, right? And it's like no, like atheists don't go and murder and rape people because they don't want to, because there's an intrinsic moral drive. And I I really hope that the only thing stopping you is not some fear of punishment, right? I hope that that's just something you don't want to do to other people.
Exactly. Well, it's what makes me such a big fan of the morality's corporation perspective, because it takes away that sort of extrinsic religious motivation for behaving a certain way and just says, you know what, morality is a system we evolved to cooperate better amongst each other, and it makes us feel good to be good to each other. And
yeah, it's so funny to be, what was the term, descriptive rather than
prescriptive.
Yeah,
yeah.
And to be, again, I often say this about mental health, to look at something and describe it more as a collection of behaviors as opposed to a specific objective thing in itself. Right. To understand that morality is more like a rough description of the way that people roughly behave in certain contexts for some reason.
Yeah. But it's interesting because you have pointed to a couple of problematic elements of it. And I think using Sancho as a disciplinary tool definitely, as you say, sort of speaks to the extrinsic rather than intrinsic thing. And that's probably a problem that you want to separate. Yeah. And then there's the sort of wealth effect, the wealth differential of,
Yes. Families. Oh, that's for me, that's the biggest thing.
And I think if you're saying Santa rewards good kids with lots of presents, that's tough on kids in differing economic circumstances.
Absolutely.
Or in even good economic circumstances, because then, you're sort of perpetuating this sort of moral sense of behavior for the wrong reasons.
I also think there's a weird culture. So my family, for example, isn't big on Christmas gift giving, right? Mm-hmm. And this is for a mixture of consumerist and personal perspectives. I mean, basically, especially now, the point I'm in my life, if there are things that I want or need, I just kind of buy them.
For myself.
I'm an adult. I have a job. It used to be that Christmas was a night, and birthdays and stuff were nice excuses to, get people things that really they needed, like a laptop or a phone or whatever, right? Maybe you get a particularly nice one because of those occasions. And at some point, it just, for us particularly, we live across the planet from each other. It's kind of like the only thing we really care about is spending the time together. I guess it's nice to have something to open. So, buy a little something. But really, I do not care about having some naff thing to open. The point is that I spend a week or two with my family.
We had a really interesting discussion about this about a month ago. It was probably a good time to bring this in, just about gifts in general. Do you remember? And we were talking about expensive gifts versus sort of well thought through gifts.
Oh, so this is a great example. We did Secret Santa in the office. Mm-hmm. I decided, this year everyone has to make a gift for someone, right? And at first, everyone was like, that's really annoying. That's a lot of effort. But I'm going to put it out there. I think it's been the best Secret Santa that we ever did.
Yeah.
Because instead of getting some naff 15-pound thing where, at best, it's a joke. Mm-hmm. And at worst, it's a total waste of money. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Everyone got something where, even if it was kind of pointless, someone had to make the effort of making it.
Yeah.
So a lot of people, Luke, developer of ours, who does listen to the show, hey Luke, he baked someone gingerbread.
And Luke can't bake.
Luke can't bake at all. He accidentally grilled the gingerbread. Tig received some cupcakes with a little Attack on Titan pictures on top.
Oh yeah, he loves that.
All of these things were I received, we used to have a little, this is going to sound random, we had a little solar pug and someone made a little paper cardboard version. All of these were great gifts that people care about and remember much more.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting thing, because I think it can easily in our culture, and when we were talking about this, we were talking about buying someone a gift who'd taken us to an event, and we're like, God, the event was the event was worth a certain amount of money, and so it sort of felt like proportionally we needed to spend, maybe not equivalent, but you want to spend something in return, and there's a sort of reciprocity there, and I think that's a valid way to feel. However, what was really interesting was when we got the gifts, we got an expensive bottle of alcohol and then a really cheap but quite sentimental little cricket bat.
A friend of ours took us to the cricket,
didn't he?
We got expensive alcohol and a little play cricket bat to play in the corridor at work,
and it was so funny because we gave him the gifts and he opened the bottle of gin or whatever and was like, cool. And he opened the cricket bat and his eyes lit up and he was like, no!
it was the child in him. It kind of comes back to that whole a thoughtful gift. So making something, buying something cheap but thoughtful, that's what matters, right? Whereas instead we end up in this weird thing where we buy kids gifts they don't need or want that much.
And each other and friends and stuff.
Right? And it's, maybe they really want that console or whatever, but it's not you reach a certain point, a certain age and maturity where it's what you want to feel is acknowledged and loved. I don't need things.
Yeah. And I think this is, I think a lot of people certainly feel there's that unpleasant element of consumerism around Christmas. Mm. There's so much marketing and it's, there's an uncomfortable element to it just because a lot of the branding and advertising does play on like the magic of Christmas. Give, you know, give the magic of Christmas. And,
basically,
and love
you're
and,
you're a shitty parent if you don't buy them the new PS5.
Yeah. And I that's actually, I think definitely that's a way that people don't really want to feel. I think a lot of people increasingly, maybe not increasingly, maybe it's always been the case, but there's a lot of people who sort of reject that consumerist aspect to Christmas or find it uncomfortable, right?
Yeah. Note for future as a parent, I'll make some weird rules, organized fun. We each have to make a gift for each other.
Yeah.
But yes.
But great. No, I think that's so a nice note to sort of wrap up on, I guess.
Yeah.
There.
So, a little detour, but overall, I think we roughly said where we're at. It feels like we both are into the deception, but not the lie.
I think it's tricky. I think, yeah, it's one of those things you'd like to take the position of just tell it as a story. I think in practice, when you've got a little kid who's just there, like, you know, wanting to believe
so
in
you're
it.
More on the lie side than I am.
I don't know. I think in practice, I'm like, you want to sort of believe it's a story. You also, we didn't talk about this, but you also don't want your kid to get bullied for...
The difficult thing then is conformity as well. You know what? I'm going to be honest, and this is such a lazy and terrible answer. I feel like this is one of those things where I would just kind of defer to what my partner wanted. Like, I don't feel that strongly on it. Like, I'm not like a douche, like, hyper-intellectual person who's like, why would I lie to my child about this? My child is far too smart for this. Mm. You know, I just don't feel strongly on it.
Yeah, I think that's a fair enough note to end on.
Cool. Post-conclusion, you know, a little wrap-up stuff. Guys, if you have anything you'd like to say to us, questions you'd like to ask, topics you'd like to suggest, or thoughts you'd like us to read out in a future episode, hit us up on Twitter, Facebook, follow our Instagram for memes. Our metaphorical door is always open.
We've had some really nice reviews lately, so thank you for leaving those, and certainly we're really grateful for all the ones that we received. Had a couple we just wanted to read out. One said, "This is a great podcast. I really enjoy it and would very much recommend." Nice and generic, but we'd love to see it. The other one goes, "A great mixture of lighthearted and flippant conversation with wealth thought out, well-researched discussion that challenges our established thinking. A great job, guys."
Yeah.
That's exactly what we go for.
Yes. Guys, we read and we'll reply to every single message. In future, we'll be reading out messages that we receive. So if you send a message, we will follow that up. Thank yous to Martha Caddick for the notes, Kane for editing, Shoreditch's Dream Factory for providing the studio. I mean, that makes it sound like they donate it to us. We're members. to all the listeners for getting through to the end here and maybe leaving a nice review. And also to Tig, who's sitting here with us. He's waving.
I'm not waving this time.
He's learning.
He's learned a bit that you can't see him. Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys. Cheers.